This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to community news covering Milford and its surrounding towns. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. This is Sarah Susskind. In the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the Milford Daily News covering the week of May 19th through May 26th, 2026. If you are listening on May 27th at 8 a.m., Poets Corner is coming up next at 9 o'clock. Our first article, Knock on Wood, to bring funny songs, rock covers to Milford, Massachusetts Library. Knock on Wood, a folk duo known for funny original songs and rock covers, is set to perform a free concert early next month at the Milford Town Library, according to a community announcement. Showtime is at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, June 2nd. The library is at 80 Spruce Street. The duo, which includes guitarist Howie Newman and fiddler Joe Kessler, will perform a variety of songs. Their repertoire includes everything from Tom Petty to Buffalo Springfield to the Stray Cats, according to the announcement. The concert is part of a program supported in part by a grant from the Milford Cultural Council, a local agency supported by the Mass Cultural Council, a state agency. Newman, who plays acoustic guitar, harmonica, and provides vocals, is the singer-songwriter of the duo, according to the announcement. His performances often include comedy and audience participation, and his songs cover topics ranging from his wife's inability to parallel park to aging, technology, and baseball. He also has heartwarming songs about his first grandchild and surviving the pandemic. Kessler plays fiddle and mandolin, bringing an energetic improvisational style that spans folk, rock, jazz, and bluegrass, according to the announcement. He has toured extensively throughout the United States, Canada, and other countries, performing with a variety of musicians. "We're not the traditional guitar and fiddle duo," Newman said in a statement. "Joe and I like to keep things up-tempo and get the audience involved. The idea is to play some great music and have fun." For more information about Knock on Wood, including videos and music samples, visit howienewman.com/knockonwood. Our next article. He stood out and stood up. Barney Frank, Massachusetts congressman, first congressman to voluntarily come out as gay, dies. Barney Frank, a longtime Massachusetts lawmaker who was the first U.S. congressman to voluntarily come out as gay, died May 19th after being in hospice care in Maine. He was 86. Frank, from Newton, represented the 4th Congressional District of Massachusetts in the U.S. House of Representatives from 1981 to 2013. During his time in office, he became one of the most powerful Democrats as the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. He has been such a tremendous person, not just for Massachusetts, but for the entire country. This makes us very sad. He stood out and stood up and was a voice for so many people when they had no voice. He has made so many tremendous positive changes for, again, not only Massachusetts and as our state, but our country. This is a great loss for our country, said Massachusetts State President Karen Spilka, Democrat Ashland. When he retired, the district stretched from Newton down to Taunton, Fall River, and New Bedford. "He'll be a great loss. I learned a lot from Congressman Frank, as brilliant as he was, and I don't think there was a more brilliant mind than I've ever met, more well-read person than I've ever met." "He had really good political instincts," said State Senator Michael Rodriguez, Democrat Westport, who said Frank was a very close friend of his. In 1987, Frank became the first member of Congress to choose to publicly come out as gay. In 2012, he became the first member of Congress to be in a same-sex marriage when he married his longtime partner, Jim Reddy. Frank earned a reputation as a staunchly liberal politician, becoming an early supporter of progressive causes like prohibiting discrimination in housing and employment based on sexual orientation. In an interview with New York Magazine in 2012, he said that he decided to work hard for gay rights when running for office because it would be totally dishonorable, being gay, not to do that. He was, above all else, a wonderful brother. I was lucky to be his sister, Frank's sister Doris Bray told NBC 10 Boston Wednesday, May 20th. Frank's long tenure was not without scandals. In 1989, Frank had an affair with a male prostitute, which is illegal in Massachusetts, and the man ran an escort service out of Frank's apartment. Critics also sought to blame Frank for the 2007 housing crisis because of his role as chairman of the Financial Services Committee. And known for a bellicose demeanor, he wasn't always the most likable politician. As congressman, Barney Frank left an indelible mark on public life in Boston, our Commonwealth, and the country. He did so with common sense, penetrating intelligence, and his trademark wit. He embodied the very best of our Democratic Party. A steadfast champion of our core principles, Barney's deep commitment to the people he served earned him the respect and admiration of colleagues and constituents alike, said Massachusetts Democratic Party Chair Steve Kerrigan in a statement. All Americans owe a debt of gratitude to Barney for his leadership in expanding civil rights and creating a fairer and more responsive financial system. Barney's legacy is defined not only by his legislative achievements, but by his unwavering dedication to fairness, accountability, and the enduring belief that government can be a force for meaningful, positive change in people's lives. On a personal note, as a proud gay man, I am deeply inspired by the presence of leaders like Barney Frank, someone who not only broke barriers, but did so with courage, authenticity, and an unwavering commitment to public service, he added. Seeing him live openly and serve with distinction helped affirm that there is a place for all of us in shaping the future exactly as we are. Frank weathered all of the challenges, building up a strong rapport with his constituents and winning re-elections by wide margins. He was a strong advocate for the poor, the middle class, and other liberal causes, and brought a lot of money for localized projects into Massachusetts through pork barrel spending. In 2010, he led the overhaul of financial regulations that aimed to address the causes of the 2007 crisis, now known as the Dodd-Frank Act. In the aftermath of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, Barney Frank was the gravelly-voiced, smart-as-a-whip congressman who fought hard to get the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau over the finish line. His one-liners were wicked and wickedly funny. Barney delivered for working people, and the world is a poorer place without him, said U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat, Massachusetts, in a statement. Frank was born in New Jersey and attended Harvard University for his undergraduate and law degrees. Prior to serving at the federal level, Frank was a member of the Massachusetts House of Representatives from 1973 to 1980. In 2022, Frank's former aide, Eric Orner, released a comic book about Frank's life titled Smart Guy, The Life and Times of Barney Frank. Frank kept a toe in controversial political conversations even at the end of his life. In his book, released in 2026, The Hard Path to Unity, Why We Must Reform the Left to Rescue Democracy, He argued that Democrats have lost voters on economic and social issues and that the party should back away from issues like transgender rights. Our next article, Massachusetts Senate aims to crack down on puppy mills. Massachusetts legislators are looking to join a growing number of states in banning pet shops from selling dogs and cats. The bill is in the House Ways and Means Committee, where it needs to be passed before heading to the full House. The state Senate unanimously passed the Pets Act, which they described as anti-animal cruelty legislation, in March. In addition to a ban on the sale of cats and dogs at pet shops, it would also take a variety of actions on animal testing and ownership. The pet shop component of the bill will cut down on the puppy mill to pet shop pipeline, saying in a press release that for-profit sales of the animals are often linked to high-volume commercial breeders, sometimes known as puppy mills. They are following several other states who have already passed similar legislation, including nearby Maine, New York, and Vermont. Many cities in Massachusetts, too, already have similar bans. Boston, for example, passed the puppy mill bill in 2016. What would the Pets Act do? The Pets Act would ban retail pet shops from selling dogs or cats and would implement fines of up to $5,000 for violations. However, it would allow pet shops to partner with animal rescues or shelter organizations to showcase dogs and cats for adoption. The bill would also implement a sweeping set of other laws related to the treatment and ownership of animals. Here are some of the provisions. Directs the Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities to create a pet ownership program for residents of public housing. Prohibits manufacturers from testing cosmetic or household products on animals if there are alternative test methods. Instead of euthanasia, directs product testing facilities to assess the health of tested dogs or cats and make an effort to put healthy animals up for adoption. Bans owners from subjecting pets to cruel conditions, including inadequate food, water, and sanitary conditions. Arguments for and against pet shop rule. A myriad of animal rights groups are supporting the legislation, including MSPCA Angel, the Animal Rescue League of Boston, and the Humane World for Animals. Through our animal shelters, veterinary hospitals, and humane law enforcement work, the MSPCA Angel sees firsthand the impact that inhumane practices have on the animals we share our lives and spaces with. Kara Holmquist, Director of Advocacy, MSPCA Angel, said in a statement, adding, "The act will ensure Massachusetts remains a leader in animal protection." But opponents say the legislation would punish responsible pet owners that do not work with puppy mills. They also said it won't hurt puppy mills, arguing instead that people will find dogs from puppy mills through shady areas of the internet. Our next article, Massport offers sneak peek at Logan Remote Terminal. Framingham. A first-of-its-kind remote terminal that will allow Logan Express passengers to clear TSA security before arriving at Boston Logan International Airport will open on June 1st, Massachusetts Port Authority officials announced during a media preview on Monday, May 18th, at the site. The new facility at 19 Flutie Pass is designed to replicate the experience of checking in at Logan. Upon entering, travelers will find a traditional baggage check setup where gate agents process luggage and send it through the standard airport system. From there, passengers proceed through full TSA screening, staffed by TSA agents and equipped with the same technology used at Logan's terminals. After clearing security, travelers wait in a secured seating area before boarding a Logan Express bus. TSA PreCheck will be accepted, though PreCheck passengers will remain in the same line. Buses will run every hour on the hour, said Peter Howe, Deputy Director of Roadway Management at Massport. All of the functions that we do at the airport, we are just shifting that to here, Howe said. It's going to be more seamless, more convenient. Straight to the gate at Logan. Once the bus arrives at Boston Logan International Airport, passengers are dropped off directly on the air side of terminals, bypassing airport security lines. During the pilot program, the service is limited to Delta passengers flying out of Terminal A or JetBlue out of Terminal C. Daniel Blake, Vice President of Airport Experience for JetBlue, says he's confident in the security measures in place and is eager to hear how customers respond to the new option. Being able to get all the way to your gate is something that we're interested in and looking forward to seeing customer feedback, especially when traveling with families or you're going to be making the trip anyway. We think that this is going to be something that is successful, Blake said. He added that JetBlue may consider similar programs at other Logan Express locations if the pilot proves successful. Logan Express also operates from Braintree, Danvers, Woburn, and Back Bay. Landline brings secure transportation expertise. Massport is partnering with the Landline Company, a third-party contractor that operates similar secure land-to-air transfer services in Pennsylvania and Illinois for passengers connecting between regional airports and larger hubs such as Philadelphia and Chicago. The Logan Express model differs in that it begins at a remote terminal rather than another airport. Landline CEO David Sundy said the company's experience positions the program for success. That's the magic of this, he said. The stress and the headache that you experience when you're pulling up to a big airport, you're wondering how long is the baggage line, how long is the security line, all these anxieties that come to your mind, we take care of all those up front. Officials did not provide detailed information about the security protocols for the buses and terminal, but expressed confidence in the systems in place. Howe noted that if a bus were to break down and require replacement, passengers would be dropped off at the landside area of Logan and would need to go through traditional airport security. We have a lot of confidence in the integrity of our security protocol, Sundy said. We've worked with TSA for years and refined them, made them better, and they meet all of TSA's standards, so we feel really confident of how it works. What travelers need to know. The Framingham facility will open at 3 a.m. daily and serve flights departing from 5:30 a.m. until 4 p.m. The cost of the service matches the existing Logan Express fare at $9. Parking at the Framingham remote terminal is $7 per day, a significant savings compared to Logan Airport's $46 daily rate. Tickets remain free for passengers 17 and under. Each bus holds up to 55 passengers. Howe said the pilot program is expected to reduce congestion both at Logan and on roadways between Framingham and the airport. Although the pilot is scheduled for 3 months, officials said it could be extended depending on customer feedback and operational results. How to book. When booking, the system recommends 3 to 4 bus departure times based on the traveler's flight schedule. How advises passengers to arrive at the terminal 45 minutes to an hour before the bus departs and to plan for a total window of 2.5 to 3 hours before their flight. Reservations for the pilot program are now open. Tickets can be purchased at LoganExpress.com up to 90 days in advance of the travel day. Our next article. Framingham is a very interesting town. Meet city's new historian, Kevin Swope. Kevin Swope may not be a townie, but he loves Framingham history. A longtime volunteer with the Framingham History Center and a member of the Framingham Historical Commission, Swope is the new city historian. He replaces Frederick Wallace, who stepped down from the volunteer position on December 31st, after serving since 2007, a period during which Framingham transitioned from a town to a city. Swope was recently sworn in after being appointed by Mayor Charlie Sissitsky. "Framingham is a very interesting town," said Swope. "It's kind of an urban, suburban, and rural town all mixed into one. It's diverse, diverse economically, racially, socially. It's a very interesting town, now city, historically." Swope, who grew up in New Hampshire, developed a love of history in childhood. He holds a master's degree in American history. "I've always been interested in history," he said. "I was always the kid who, when their grandmother talked about old times, I would sit there and really pay attention." Our next article. Colonels suspend State Police Academy. It is more dangerous, less effective than most. Poor management, inadequate oversight, and an entrenched culture of over-the-top paramilitary training make the Massachusetts State Police Training Academy more dangerous and less effective than many of its peers, a third-party study released May 20th found. The $600,000 study, ordered by Governor Maura T. Healey following the 2024 death of Worcester trainee Enrique Delgado Garcia, yielded more than 100 recommendations and prompted the agency to indefinitely delay its upcoming annual academy, which had been scheduled to start in June. "We are fully committed to implementing these recommendations and to maintaining the focus needed to strengthen the academy over the long term," said Colonel Jeffrey Noble, who decided to suspend the academy until dozens of reforms he identified as crucial are implemented. Noble, at a press conference May 19th, said the department would honor the memory of Delgado Garcia, who died following an academy boxing exercise, by meaningful action. The colonel, who came on the job just weeks after the recruit's death, largely declined to comment on the manslaughter charges a prosecutor brought against 4 of his troopers, citing the open case. The 112-page report that led Noble to order reforms, produced by the International Association of Chiefs of Police, did not examine the specific circumstances surrounding Delgado Garcia's death. The report, styled as a comprehensive operational and cultural assessment of the state's police sprawling new Braintree Academy, only appeared to allude to the death once in passing. However, in scrutinizing injury rates and operations for the past 10 training academies, the report was highly critical of the paramilitary tactics offered at the academy, including the boxing program. The report found the academy has high injury and dropout rates that it attributed to widespread failures in policy and practice. Policies on paper lay out safety protocols and require injuries to be promptly reported. However, in practice, the report said, drill instructors often go off script and trainees feel pressure to keep injuries to themselves. Authors of the report, who observed training exercises at the academy, reported witnessing senior officers who appeared to approve of training tactics they deemed excessive, lacking purpose, and demeaning to the trainees. A shift toward sustainable, job-relevant, ethically sound fitness practices with protected recovery periods, comprehensive safety oversight, formal concussion awareness training, and established culture of safety is essential, they wrote. Reform must prioritize evidence-based programming, eliminate punitive physical training, ensure adequate recovery, expand qualified staffing, and create systems that proactively prevent injuries rather than reactively responding to them. The report also questioned the value of head strike training exercises, including boxing, which state police, May 20th, said they would end permanently. The department said it would also implement a number of other safety reforms before starting the next academy, including some that, the report indicated, had been suggested 20 years ago. Program under scrutiny. The State Police Academy has faced scrutiny for decades. Two recruits died there in the 1980s. No charges were issued in those deaths, the Boston Globe reported, and in 2022, the department reassigned staffers after unauthorized bear crawls on hot pavement. The state in 2006 released another report commissioned after allegations of hazing that made a series of recommendations for reforms. In many key areas, little has changed or improved as a result of the recommendations provided in that report, the May 20th report says. The 2006 report, the Boston Herald reported, criticized oversight and training, highlighted personnel shortages, and said the academy failed to adequately screen recruits to ensure they had the physical and mental strength to withstand the rigorous 26-week program. The 2026 report echoed all these critiques. It noted the academy relies on a single fitness staff member and focused at length on deficiencies in the screening process. The authors said the department lacks appropriate fitness benchmarks and does not properly assess the physical and mental capabilities of applicants, allowing underprepared trainees to enter training. This dynamic results in a high number of dropouts and injuries that could have been preventable, said the authors, who faulted the department for not properly documenting injuries or studying trends to avoid them. The report found that many of the same injuries, including to the legs and shoulders, recur as a result of unduly harsh training regimens, including unscheduled and punitive exercises. The use of physical training as a form of punishment is explicitly discouraged by leading fitness and tactical training bodies, the authors wrote, calling the practice not only physiologically unsound, but also ethically problematic. Reform efforts must center on the adoption of fitness protocols that are legally defensible, job-specific, and health-promoting, they added. Stress testing critiqued. While the 2026 study faulted police for not improving in key problem areas identified decades ago, its authors also faulted the 2006 report for recommending the department keep some high-stress tactics they found to be inappropriate. Authors said the 2006 report supported many ritualistic and outdated exercises aimed at subjecting trainees to stress for fear that dialing back the intensity would put a stigma on new officers of not having succeeded in the same manner as all other officers of the department. The authors found many of the stress tests served no legitimate purpose, including one in which trainees were shouted at that, the authors wrote, were watched with tacit approval by high-level command staff. An often repeated goal of some members of the Academy staff is to be a preeminent law enforcement training agency that delivers cutting-edge training, the report found. However, continued reliance on tradition, outdated rituals, and a desire to exceed the stress exposure experienced by prior recruit classes will stifle this goal. The 2026 authors said that while stress exposure in purposeful training exercises is an important component of training, such exercises should prioritize skill level, psychological readiness, and mutual respect over indiscriminate stress exposure. They recommended the department strike a better balance with their stress exposure, something Noble vowed to do before opening another academy. Noble said he did not have a timetable for when enough reforms might be implemented to begin the next academy. Other reforms that will need to be implemented include establishing a civilian academy director of training position, establishing baseline physical and psychological screening protocols, reinforcing a safety-first culture through training, and building stronger systems for injury tracking and recruit readiness. Noble vows serious changes. Noble, in a background interview with reporters invited to headquarters May 19th, thanked the International Association of Chiefs of Police for the report and said implementing its recommendations was a priority. A condition of the invitation was that reporters not quote Noble directly on his answers to questions about the report, though they could report the information he provided. Reporters were given a physical copy of the lengthy report at the same time Noble gave quotable opening remarks that could be recorded. Recording of his background answer session was barred. Noble, in answering questions from reporters, said he could not speak for why prior leaders did not implement previously identified reforms, but vowed he would ensure transparency and improvements moving forward. Noble said a key part of the reform effort will be to find the right balance when it comes to rigor. While he said he supports developing a balanced stress training curriculum, he noted that such training is essential to ensuring the state produces troopers capable of handling life-threatening situations. He noted, for example, that a third-year trooper recently helped stop a potentially disastrous mass shooting attempt on Memorial Drive in Cambridge by confronting the gunman as he fired on helpless motorists. Our next article, Anti-Semitic Racist Graffiti Found at Natick School. Shortly after anti-Semitic and racist graffiti were found on the exterior of Lilia Elementary School in Natick, town and school officials condemned the act of hate. The town of Natick, the Natick Police Department, and Natick Public Schools unequivocally condemned this act. An open letter to the community dated May 18th states, "Anti-Semitism, racism, and hate have no place in Natick. We recognize the harm that incidents like this cause for students, families, staff, and all members of our community, and we do not minimize it." The letter was signed in solidarity by the town of Natick, the Natick Police Department, and Natick Public Schools. Also, according to the letter, hateful language and symbols, including a swastika and an anti-black racial slur, were discovered on the exterior of the Lilia Elementary School, 41 Beacon Street. According to the letter, the offending material was removed. The incident remains under investigation. "We are committed to identifying those responsible and ensuring accountability," the letter states. "Just as importantly, we remain committed to continuing the work of education, dialogue, and community partnership to confront hate and foster a safe, welcoming, and inclusive environment for all." Local rabbi says he appreciates town's quick response. Ken Richmond, co-senior rabbi for Temple Israel of Natick on Hartford Street, said he appreciated the town's swift response. "It's always a shame when something like this happens," he told the Daily News. "I appreciate the town's, the police department's, and the school department's condemning of it. We know the vast majority of people in town are good people and good neighbors who support each other." Richmond said incidents like this can upset members of his congregation. "We tell them, unfortunately, there are people in this world who spread hate of various kinds, including anti-Semitism, and it's up to each of us to be proud of our faith and our heritage and not to let the few haters deter us," he said. Anti-Semitism has previously reared its ugly head in Natick. Last August, someone spray-painted swastikas on several signs along the Cochituate Rail Trail. In April 2023, a swastika was found painted on the pavement near the West Natick MBTA station. And in March 2022, an anti-Semitic slur was found on bathroom walls at Natick High School. According to the open letter, along with the investigation into the incident, the town is working to determine long-term, proactive efforts that protect against similar hate incidents. "Natick is committed to proactive efforts that protect all who call Natick home," the letter states. Our next article, Dover Saddlery announces store closures and layoffs. Dover Saddlery, a Massachusetts-based equestrian retailer, announced several store closures and said it may lay off 112 employees this summer. The company, headquartered in Littleton, said in a worker adjustment and retraining notification, WARN, filing this month, that the layoffs and closures depend in part on our success in obtaining funding or selling our business. The retailer sells saddles, riding clothes, helmets, grooming equipment, and other horse gear online and through at least 30 stores across the U.S., including 5 in New England. In the past week, several Dover Saddlery locations have posted about store closing sales on their individual Facebook pages. In Massachusetts, the Wellesley store said in a post that it will soon be closing its doors. Stores in Plaistow, New Hampshire, North Kingston, Rhode Island, and Richfield and Manchester, Connecticut, shared the same message. "Thank you for your support and loyalty over the years. Serving you and your horse has truly been our privilege, and we're grateful for the trust you've placed in us," the stores wrote. "We've cherished every moment spent helping you pursue your passion and supporting the equestrian community." The posts also announced 20% store closing sales. Dover Saddlery was founded in Wellesley in 1975 by Jim and David Powers, top-ranked riders in the U.S. equestrian team, according to the company's website. Promis Equity Partners, LLC, acquired the company in April 2022. Dover Saddlery did not immediately respond to a request for a comment. When would the Dover Saddlery workers be laid off? If layoffs occur, all jobs at the Dover Saddlery facility at 525 Great Road in Littleton would be eliminated between July 7th and July 20th, the company said in the WARN filing. Some employees may stay on longer to assist with the closure. All layoffs are expected to be permanent, and no bumping rights will be granted to any employee, Dover Saddlery wrote. Affected employees will receive written notice of their potential job elimination. The company has not provided staffing numbers for its individual store locations. What is a WARN notice? The Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification Act, passed in 1988, ensures workers have ample time to prepare for job transitions. A WARN filing is required when a worksite closing or mass layoffs affect at least 50 employees and a third of the site's total workforce. Our next article. Boston area real estate agents weigh in on summer market. The spring real estate market in eastern Massachusetts has been active and strong, according to several greater Boston real estate agents. Inventory remains tight, other than the luxury market, and buyers might need to be a bit more realistic about what's reasonable. And while mortgage rates are not down drastically, they are about 50 basis points lower than they were at this time last year. 6.37% for a 30-year loan versus 6.86%. One of the biggest differences this season is that buyers are no longer making emotional decisions as quickly as they did during the peak frenzy years, said realtor Nancy Moore of Sotheby's International Realty's Needham office. They still move fast on the right home, but they're more thoughtful about value, condition, future maintenance, and monthly carrying costs. At the same time, Moore said many sellers are still carrying very low existing mortgage rates, which continue to limit inventory because people are hesitant to move unless they truly need to. That combination, cautious buyers and constrained inventory, is creating a market where strategy matters more than hype, Moore said. The homes that stand out are those that are properly prepared, marketed well, and aligned with what today's buyers truly want. Is this a real estate market bust? Through March 31st, the median single-family home price for what the Warren Group describes as Greater Boston, a cluster of 139 communities east of Interstate 495, is $760,000, up 1.3% from year-ago median of $750,000. Buyers are market-educated, serious, and they get it. Prices aren't coming down, said Lisa White, 2026 North Shore Realtors president and an agent at La Macchia Realty. They've accepted that this is the market, and they're moving with confidence. Sellers are finally letting go of 2021, she said, when anything on the market would sell, often over asking price. That is simply not the case today. For 2021, the statewide median sales price was $510,000, which was 14.1% higher than 2020, according to a Warren Group press release at the time. Moore said this real estate market means homes priced correctly from the start are moving quickly and attracting strong interest. New construction and updated turnkey homes continue to see very strong demand, she said. Luxury homes are also active, although buyers at higher price points are extremely discerning. The luxury home market includes homes priced at more than $2 million in an established, desirable area and featuring high-end amenities including elevators, an in-ground or indoor swimming pool, saunas, a multi-vehicle garage, private outdoor space, custom craftsmanship, spa-like bathrooms, a chef's kitchen, and plenty of space for entertaining. What type of home is most attractive to Greater Boston buyers? Slater Anderson, Vice President and Managing Director of Real Estate for LandVest, said new construction is what buyers are looking for, but points out there's not a lot available. Renovated homes are also selling, he said. People are willing to pay another $200,000 for a home that does not need a lot of work. Homes with updated kitchens, office space, and nice outdoor living areas are also popular. I'm also seeing some of the quirkier homes selling simply because inventory is still so limited, said realtor Laura Crowell, vice president at J. Barrett & Company, which serves several North Shore communities. Buyers are becoming more flexible and willing to take on homes they may have passed on a few years ago. Though fixer-uppers are not as in demand as they once were, there are buyers still willing to take on properties that need some TLC. You might think the fixer-uppers are sitting, but a lot of folks are aware that the best way to get bang for your buck is usually to buy that fixer-upper and renovate it yourself, said Clifford Slater, Senior Vice President of Mortgage Lending with Rate. Huge immediate projects are still a big challenge, but if it's a lot of little things that just need updating, or if the buyers are comfortable doing or managing renovations, those are getting gobbled up too. Demand for condominiums and townhouses has also increased, White said, particularly among first-time buyers looking for an entry point. Condo inventory has been improving, which is creating some good opportunities for buyers in that space. Is this turning into a buyer's market? Home buyers are a mix, White said, from eager first-time buyers who have been paying very high rents to move-up buyers whose families have grown or are working from home and need more space, and a healthy number of downsizers who are ready to simplify but don't want to leave the area they love. We're also seeing some relocation buyers, people coming from Boston proper who want more space and a different pace of life without giving up the amenities and access they're used to at a more appealing price point. An increase in multi-generational living has buyers looking for property that offers accessory dwelling unit potential. Some buyers are even specifically searching for multifamily homes so parents, adult children, or extended family can all live together while still having some independence, Crowell said. Neighborhoods, schools, proximity to public transportation, restaurants, parks, shops, and medical offices continue to have a significant role in a buyer's perspective of a property. Our next article, Massachusetts officials learn to fight cyber attacks. Worcester. Municipal officials from around Massachusetts spent Wednesday, May 13th, learning about cybersecurity, mitigating data breaches, and how to help keep local governments, school district, and other organizations safe from cyber attacks. Hundreds of officials attended the 6th annual Massachusetts Municipal Cybersecurity Summit held at the DCU Center. Dozens of experts, representatives from state and regional organizations that work daily to keep residents and organizations informed and safe, offered resources and information. The audience came from all reaches of the state. We have a large user group, 1,000 staff and 5,400 students, said Ellen Spinney, director of technology in the Fitchburg School District, who was sitting with colleagues representing the Leominster School District. Maintaining safety within the district budget poses some challenges. The goal is to keep the staff and students informed and safe as they use technology, which can be a challenge while group members are working and exploring, she noted. The educator attended the summit to learn about cybersecurity grant programs offered by the state and listen to experts detail existing and future challenges. There were some good talking points, Spinney said, adding that some of the information was unnerving, noting that there are still many challenges out there and some disquieting future challenges to come. Everyone wants birthday cake. David Balkar, dubbed a chief evangelist, an ethical hacker, and principal of NextAssure Company, was a featured speaker. His organization specializes in cybersecurity for small businesses and tackle issues from risk assessments to creating resiliency roadmaps. The company translates complexity into clarity and delivers tailored strategies that scale with your company's mission. Cyber threats range from disinformation, fake news, and hoaxes to blackmail, bullying, and financial fraud schemes and scams, Valkar told the audience. The dangers are everywhere, he said, embedded in social networks. Actors can breach systems through phishing schemes and malware. Systems are also at risk due to human error, inattention, and carelessness. Tech managers, Valkar said, can implement different protections from requiring users to create strong passwords, requiring 2- or 3-factor authentication for sign-ins, and installing AI-embedded tools that can identify synthetic content in real time. Mandated employees attend cybersecurity informational sessions or lose access to work computers and other devices could help accelerate cultural change. Creating work silos where not all employees have access to all work systems can also aid in protecting organizations from breaches. Valkar suggests that training employees to detect and report phishing attempts and other attacks can help companies avoid infiltration and data breaches. He suggested incentivizing the process of reporting phishing attempts by offering gift cards, vouchers, or even birthday cake to promote employees to be more vigilant and provide tech managers with information about attempted breaches. It turns out everyone wants birthday cake, Valkar said. A key feature of the summit was the release of the report examining the impact of data breaches in Massachusetts that quantifies and analyzes the data breaches reported to the state in 2024 from January 1st to December 31st. State law mandates reporting all breaches to state officials, including the Attorney General's Office of Consumer Affairs and the State Office of Consumer Affairs and Business Regulation. Letters alerting consumers to the breach are issued, and state officials investigate violations of state security regulations. Massachusetts organizations sustained 2,292 breaches over the course of the year, affecting almost 4.5 million Massachusetts residents. A deep dive into the figures indicates that most malicious and criminal breaches were the result of systems intrusion, most often targeting financial institutions and services, healthcare companies, and banking systems. The report discussed the origin of the failure, including if it was faulty technology, an inside threat, or the lack of planning to secure an organization from cyber attacks. The document also discusses how organizations can prepare for data breaches while attempting to protect themselves from harm. The culture needs to change. The report was a snapshot in time of the situation, said John Petruselli, director of the Mass Cyber Center, one of the two organizations that worked on the report, with the Office of Consumer Affairs and Business Regulation. The report also explored what is in place to stop breaches before they happen. Remediation, in some cases, can boil down to changing the culture of password use, Petruselli said. Moving toward more secure passwords, from the most common password to different combinations of numbers to a multi-factor authentication system are some measures, he said. The culture needs to change, Petruselli said, noting that enforcement of password protocols would not take a great financial investment. Other free fixes include frequent updates to software operating systems and a monthly scan of the systems to seek potential data breaches and damaging incidents. Some businesses operate under the assumption that they are too small to be hit and opt out of investing in cybersecurity, Petrocelli said, noting that is a fallacy and it's a question of when, not if. Preparing for a breach, establishing company safe words, and mapping who to call and how to call to report a breach is essential to ensure that the attack is not exacerbated through ignorance or lack of planning. Petrozella's organization works to provide a technical solution to state, regional, and municipal organizations to cybersecurity issues. That includes stopping state-sponsored hackers, Russian, Chinese, Iranian, keeping organizations safe from ransom and malware groups, and protecting intellectual property. The organization works to keep employees, students, and customers safe and to protect their personal information. Petrozelli suggested consumers can use a tool available for free to assess whether their emails have been compromised. A panel discussion featured Petrozelli and state officials Leila D'Amelia, the Undersecretary of the Office of Consumer Affairs and Business Regulation, and Jared Reiheimer from the Attorney General's Office of Privacy and Responsible Technology. The discussion included advice to consumers affected by data breaches, including to freeze their credit reports with the reporting agencies, a free service for all. The panelists discussed the reported breaches, with 30-40% reported by small companies. Franklin officials Andrew Messier and Al Gardner attended the event to add to their knowledge and learn what additional steps to take to keep the municipality secure. They were also taking the opportunity to network and determine what the state offers in grant opportunities and different software products. We're getting ideas from other municipalities, learning what they have in place and how to improve our measures, Gardner said. You have been listening to a reading of the Milford Daily News. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Sarah Susskind. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is BirdNote. I'm Marcus Rostin, and while working for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, I assisted in a study into the behaviors of one of my favorite birds, the American woodcock. Woodcocks look like a shorebird that got lost in the woods. Their brown and black speckles camouflage them perfectly until they sing, which sounds less like singing and more like yelling the word paint over and over. We spent many nights waiting for the sun to set and the painting to begin. We caught and equipped a female with a band and a GPS backpack to track her live as she migrated. We observed this bird flying over 600 miles south from Buffalo to spend the winter in North Carolina. One night, she flew nearly 400 miles without stopping. Picturing that bird on winter vacation on the coast reminded me how birds connect us all, from Iroquois National Wildlife Refuge in western New York to the Croatan National Forest in North Carolina, and all the stopover habitats in between. We need to prioritize protecting our grasslands and young growth forests so the woodcock's powerful peints can be heard long into the future. This week is Black Birders Week. To learn how to participate, follow the hashtag Black Birders Week on social media and visit birdnote.org.